It's time now for World Watchers International with Mae Brussel, who for over 17 years has investigated and exposed political conspiracies worldwide. World Watchers International originates at KLRB, Carmel, California. Here's Mae.
Good evening. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California. It's program number 528, January the 18th, 1982. My voice is hoarse this evening. I don't think I'll lose the voice I did several weeks ago, but it's just hoarse and tired from a difficult week I just spent in L.A. I got up about an hour ago after being fogged out of that city for 24 hours, and the airport experience was interesting. I left there last night. The flight was canceled to come back to Carmel, so I thought I'd take a chance if a cab driver would and go to my sister-in-law and stay there instead of sleeping on one of those plastic chairs in the airport or nearby. So I got into a cab, and the cab driver didn't speak English, but I knew the directions, one block at a time for 3 to 5 miles. To where she lived, it was pea soup fog. You couldn't see the street signs or the right or left or curbs. And I got in the cab, and I just told him to go to the main street, Sepulveda, and head north because there's lights on that street. Maybe we could make it. And he didn't speak very well. His English wasn't very good, and many of the people there are from Latin America. And I said, what country are you from? And he said, the Soviet Union. And I thought, well, boy, if we're going along floating like on clouds, you know, just finding our way a foot at a time and stretching a few miles drive for about an hour and a half to get there. And I was fascinated talking to him. He's from Minsk, and he'd been in this country 6 months. And I started asking him, you know, how he happened to come to this country. And he said that he was a Christian and he went to the Orthodox Church in the Soviet Union. And they said, well, if you want to go to church, you better go to America, get out of Russia. So they sent him back home to his family. The police called him in and asked him why he wanted to pray. This is his story he was telling me in broken English. He's only been here 6 months. So between the fog and the English, he was trying very hard to find words that he could say it, but this was the gist of it, that he went to Vienna, and then he was told that he would have free passport and a permanent visa. He's a permanent citizen, and he could bring his family, only his brothers, in Minsk. And he has relatives in North Hollywood, and he's already driving a cab at the airport in Los Angeles. And I thought that was a really fast transition. And I said, when the Russians told you to leave, how did you get the money to come to this country if they didn't want you there? And they said, well, go to America. He said, my transportation was paid for me. And just as Lee Oswald got his transportation from the American government to come home when he was over there, they sent him the money and for him and Marina. And this fellow said, my transportation was paid for him and the family. And he just simply had to get as far as Vienna. And he was to America. And he's now, as I say, working in the cab. For the cab. Now, he runs his own cab. And I said to him, the problem that presses on my mind so much, are you Jewish? And he said, no. And I said, is there much feeling against the Jews in Minsk? What is the situation? Because we hear so much about the Jew in Minsk. And he said, I said, do they have houses? Yes, they have houses. Do they have schools? Yes. Do they have jobs? Yes, they had them. But they weren't treated different. He had friends in school that were Jewish. There wasn't much separation. Didn't know the word racism here yet, or said he didn't, between his experiences with a Jew or with other non-Jews, until the Jewish groups in America began sending letters to the Jewish relatives, get out of the Soviet Union, you are oppressed. And the Zionist organizations, and he knew the word Zionist, he said the Zionist organizations were the troublemakers, and that they kept asking for all the Jews because the Jews were being oppressed. And his feeling, this is just his word or whatever he was telling me, was that they were all right until the Americans kept instigating problems and writing to them and telling them they would be well off and that they don't have the right standard of living and they can't have free speech. And they instigated the movement to free the Soviet Jewry to such an extent that he said the problems with the Soviet Jews came from the Zionists and from Americans who kept telling them how bad off they were and how they should get out. And the Soviet Union was willing to let them go to Israel. if they were Jewish and for that purpose. So the passports were written for Israel by way of Vienna, but when they got to Vienna, they went to the United States and Australia, so the visas were stopped. But his feelings were that the Zionists were the troublemakers in this situation, and I have long expressed my attitude on this program based upon many books that I keep reading and picking up new books, that a lot of the Zionist group was formed by that Nazi German in Palestine, Otto von Bollschwing, that I've mentioned before on this program, and we have to do more about this particular character, or more Martin Bormann, who studied Theodor Herzl and Zionism and Folke Bernadotte and Himmler, and there were certain Germans, Nazis, that felt if the Jews want a homeland, we'll give them a homeland, and that they were very instrumental in setting up a lot of the conditions in Palestine that did become Israel, and the basis of a lot of anti-Semitic feeling was used to place these people into this environment and then instigate anti-Russian propaganda from America, from Israel, again barraging the Russians with propaganda, how evil they are, how bad they are, never mentioning the fact of the role they played in stopping Adolf Hitler. If it hadn't been for the determination of the Russians in Leningrad, we would probably have a different form of government. Hitler would have won the war if he had won Russia, and then could have gone on to conquer the entire world. They were able to at least allow democracy to survive a few more years, 20, 30, or 50, by holding the line at that particular time. But as soon as the war was over, within 6 months, Hitler's agents were at the Pentagon, and we were already planning techniques to become anti-Russian. And this fellow, the cab driver, as much as he could express it, and under those conditions as we were going along looking for curbs, was that until the Zionists and the Americans made a lot of trouble, the Jews were not different, but now they are. Now they can't get certain jobs and can't go to the university and are treated differently, but they weren't treated differently until the trouble came from the outside. There's an article, a series of articles carried in the Los Angeles Examiner, taken from one main story in the New York Magazine. It's a series of articles I saw in Los Angeles, but the larger one is from New York Magazine by Lally Weymouth, W-E-Y-M-O-U-T-H, The Sleeping Beauty Mystery. And some of you may be following this trial of Klaus von Bülow. He's a wealthy, the husband of a wealthy woman in Long Island. Her father was George Crawford. He was a utility czar. She was raised by her grandmother, and this particular woman, her name was Sunny. Hard name to believe. She didn't have such a sunny life. She had jewels and diamond tiaras and a home like Versailles. She was extremely wealthy. She has an estate of about $35 million, and she's in a coma. And her husband has been charged, Klaus von Bülow, with injecting her with insulin and barbiturates in order to try to kill her. Now, there are a lot of bases that this brief story about her life covers. And if any of you have been missing this trial, it's going on right now. Pick up your newspaper articles and get the New York Magazine. I guess the article just came out a few weeks ago. This woman originally was in love with a man, Georgi Wasichilov. He was a czarist Russian, and they had lost their money. They were impoverished after World War I and after the Russian Revolution, and she didn't marry him. She was sent by her family to get over the love affair that she had with this first Russian czarist prince. And so she was sent to an Austrian resort where she met Princess Honeychild Hohenlohe, and she met a Austrian, Alfie von Arsberg, distinguished but impoverished Austrian family. And he was a Nazi. He was called the Austrian prince. They lived in Munich, Venice, Paris, and America, and he worked for John Paul Getty. They had mansions and servants and caviar and so forth. He fell in love with another woman, and he's been charged with putting her in a coma. She's in a permanent coma now. It doesn't seem that she'll get out of it. And he's been charged with the attempted murder. The children and the maid, her children and maid, broke into the closet and found syringes and needles with the kind of medications that were in her body when she went into the coma. But the characters step right out of the past of the Tsarist Russians, the Nazis, employed by the Getty oil people, the $35 million estate. And the running story of this particular couple is an era of going back to the Tsarist Russians, the oil people, the Grand Dame, living with the royal complex, and as I say, the jewelry and the tiara, and then the injections. And it's a story of wealth and attempted murder, and I guess you would call it murder if she doesn't get out of the coma, and a trial. Interesting thing, one of the doctors called in to this case to give testimony, the newspaper account said, comes from the Hughes Medical Institute down in Florida, the headquarters in Florida. The time I studied the Hughes Medical Institute, it actually was a building with a door with a dummy front, and I've never read of a doctor testifying at a trial from the Hughes Medical Institute. It was a tax write-off for the Summa Corporation and for Howard Hughes to give a percentage of their money to a medical institute, which is in Florida. And a chauffeur was the man who became the head of it. It was actually a dummy front that siphons money to many places with no accountability, but a lot of tax write-off. And a doctor from the Hughes Medical Institute was sent up to Howard Hughes in Boston in 1966, and he was never seen again by any single person, including Robert Mayhew and the gang that worked with him and around him. Howard Hughes wasn't seen. But there's a doctor, George Cahill, from a research doctor from Howard Hughes Medical Institute, as a state witness in the case of the coma and the insulin administered. And I thought that was kind of funny because I didn't think that the Institute even had doctors to send around. So you've got the John Paul Getty, the Tsars, the White Russians, the Hughes Medical Institute, a lot of money and a mystery story. We may not be concerned in those particular people, but the characters that weave in and out through the history from World War One up to the present are interesting. So you might get that article in New York Magazine, the entire article, or get the segments. It'd be hard to get those, try and get the whole article. I didn't know that the author, Lally Weymouth, was the daughter of Katharine Graham from the Washington Post. Somebody told me that this week. The woman who writes for New York Magazine and does a lot of articles on Jean Harris and on this Sleeping Beauty. It's called The Sleeping Beauty Mystery. A woman, very good writer, interesting writer, brings up a lot of names that could be of interest to many people. That's Katharine Graham's daughter who's doing the writing on that story. So that is another side thing to watch, to see what kind of articles her daughter writes, knowing that that's her daughter now. And being as Katharine Graham owns the Newsweek and Washington Post, I see a certain kind of coverage from there. And it'd be interesting to see if members of her family who are writing carry stories a little further than what her mother does in the Washington Post. I mentioned last Sunday night to be sure and watch Frank Turple on television. I hope most of you did or could during the week. And if you missed it because the broadcast came too late, you can write for the script of the program to World TV, Box 1000, Boston, Massachusetts, 02118. World TV, Box 1000, Boston, 02118, and send $3 and ask for the Frank Turple transcript. It's called The Confessions of a Dangerous Man. And when I got down to Los Angeles last Monday, I called quite a few people that know that I've been working on the Wilson Turple Corcola story and got as many as I could that evening to, who I thought would care or know about it, listen to this program. And they each listened for an hour and a half and some taped it or videotaped it. And the discussion of Turple and Wilson was very vague for them until they were able to see Frank Turple, as some people did on 60 Minutes, and hear him talking. And then they said, oh my God, you know, is this what you really research? Is this what you really find? I mean, where do these people come from? And even though they were names in the newspaper over the last year, year and a half, it became more real. And one picture is better than 1,000 words to see Frank Turple. Now, one of the fellows who helped write this film documentary made in England was Jim Hogan, who wrote the book Spooks, that I refer to often. And I'll just make a few points about that production, that movie, and then I'll do more, and you can order the script, and we can go over them together. One of the points that is so obvious in the story of George Coricola and Frank Turple and Edwin Wilson is that they not only worked for the CIA at one time, but they worked for the CIA even up till today. And when they asked William Colby he was in the movie for 1 second, an interview or a minute about Frank Turple leaving the CIA and having a resignation slip, or he left under mutual agreement, that the question came to William Colby, is it possible that when people leave the CIA officially, they still work for the CIA? And he said, yes, they do. You remember the time of the Watergate, E. Howard Hunt and James McCord and Eugenio Martinez and the whole gang, Gonzales, were described by the news media as being former CIA. And within 3 weeks of the Watergate arrest, I had written that they were CIA, and it turned out that they all were on the payroll of the CIA at the time of Watergate, even though they officially, McCord and Hunt, resigned in 1971, the date that Frank Turple or Edwin Wilson resigned. So they were with the CIA, and of course William Colby was there, but they didn't ask him about the Nugenhan Bank and the links of Turple to organized crime. There's only so much they could do in an hour and a half, and we've covered a lot of it on this program. Now, the important thing to remember, and I do think it's important, is that George Bush was the director of the CIA. And if I have to remind you of this every week, I will, because he was the director when Frank Turple, and let's just talk about Turple alone, was working for the CIA. Now, we got Spiro Agnew out, or he was removed because of payoffs in Maryland. There are about 55 charges that never were really delineated, although I have a list of them. Richard Nixon was out because of Watergate, and the House Intelligence Committee is already going to have open hearings on Turple and Wilson. They've had closed hearings, and they were shocking to them by their own admission, and they're going to have open hearings, and there's no reason not to call George Bush, director of the CIA, and get him involved into the Frank Turple story, because when Turple was working for the CIA, George Bush was director of the CIA at that time also, so that was his boss. So if you think that that program was nauseating with the insertion of rats into people's bodies until they ate their insides out, or the torturing racks and cutting people up, and the many things they talked about, such as putting poison into ventilator systems. Remember at the time of Watergate, they wanted the floor plans of a hotel, and then James McCord said that they could put poisons into the ventilating system at the time of the Republican or Democratic conventions, and the Legionnaires' disease with the ventilating system coming up. They had poisons for ventilating systems. He talked about that. One of the most important points of the program, of the hour and a half program, for those of you who didn't see it, was the link of these people to Aja, the man who shot and tried to kill the Pope. This was right there on your big screen on television, the links of Frank Turple from the United States CIA to Mohammed Aja, the man who shot and tried to kill the Pope. They talked about the gray wolves. Those are the werewolves. Those are the Hitler youth, the Nazi Hitler youth fascist organizations that Aja belonged to, and Turple and Wilson and Coricola have funded those groups. And one of the most revealing things was the link to the Pope shooting. There was an article in Time. Well, I'll get to that in a few minutes. I'll go over the Turple thing. But Time magazine, January the 11th, has an article, Conspiracy to Kill the Pope. And the same people who would want to kill Ronald Reagan if they didn't succeed. And remember that John Hinckley Jr. belonged to Nazi organizations in California, Chicago, and linked to North Carolina and around the country and other states, Ohio. And Time magazine has a story about the right-wing fascist group that are involved. They use the word fascist and right-wing, and then they, on this program, bring out the point of the attempt to kill the Pope, and Frank Turple involved with that, and Turple working with Aja, which makes Turple CIA and right-wing and closely aligned to what I said in May when the Pope was shot, how the CIA had tried to kill Ronald Reagan in March and the Pope in May, and went through the motives at that time, and I won't go into them again if you want me to, I can another time, on why Frank Turpel and the CIA wanted the Pope dead. As I say, remember that George Bush was part of this operation as director of the CIA, and don't think that you can pass him off as some innocent little vice president who's sitting around just carrying the crisis management team for the Polish situation. George Bush has a past. That's why he's the vice president now, and it's imperative that the House Intelligence Committee call George Bush as director of the CIA and get him under oath about his role with Frank Turpel and Edwin Wilson. That's very important. Now, the House of Torture was brought up in Uganda, and Turpel had an office upstairs on the third floor, and bodies were being literally quartered as they were in Chile and Colonia Dignidad, and limbs cut off and blood smeared. And the thing about Turpel that was so interesting, identical to the interviews with G. Gordon Liddy, is that in his own mind, he isn't more guilty than any other person that he works for and or the CIA officials, and he makes that quite clear. So when they ask him about the torture in Uganda or hearing the torture, he's not embarrassed. After all, didn't the CIA set up torture in Iran with the SAVAK and down in Chile with the DINA, D-I-N-A, the secret police, and the death squads in Brazil that came in after the coup in 1964, or in Argentina and El Salvador and Guatemala, the beheadings, the torture. I can't list those every program each Sunday where we have set that up. But there's nothing different with Frank Turpel sitting in Uganda listening to people on the first floor being cut up and beat up and recordings of their family and being told they're being killed. There's nothing different than that with that than the Shah of Iran, who Jimmy Carter, as President of the United States, praised and David Rockefeller dealt with and Henry Kissinger and so forth. Turpel was very secure that he wasn't doing anything different than other people in the CIA and in the Democratic and Republican Party, and he was very cool about it. They didn't mention his wife, who works for the CIA, who was flown out of town by Rita Jenrette, whose husband was involved in the Abscam, a large narcotic operation of Jenrette to Frank Turpel. That part was left out. They didn't intend to get into the narcotic operation. It showed him with a woman, Ruth Boyd, who seems to have some affection for him. I don't know where his wife and children are, but she seemed to be just crazy about Frank. And some people said, well, how can she like a creep like that? Well, it's very easy. And there's memories of Auschwitz and concentration camps or Dachau or Buchenwald after the gold was pulled out of the teeth, after the bodies were taken, and put into the ovens, the teeth extracted, the hair cut for pillows or whatever, the skin to make stuff, lampshades or whatever they did with bodies. Then these people went home and they procreated and made love and had new babies and had string quartets and theater at night. It was the day's work. They simply worked with people instead of hogs, and they looked at the people as hogs or as sheep, and as we do at stockyards. So Turpel is only doing a day's work. And the thing is that after World War II and all these atrocities came, if we didn't put it in the textbooks, what happened? If we didn't put it into the history books so that people would know, and now there's a resurgence to teach the Holocaust, but there's a whole generation that doesn't even know about it. As long as you don't prosecute those people who did those things, they can smile and laugh, and Mengele's can go on to South America and experiment on the Indians. And the problem is that after World War II, we quickly embraced the Germans, the Nazis. As I say, Reinhard Gehlen was taken 6 months after he was in the bunker with Hitler. He was at the Pentagon, and he writes that in his biography. 6 months later, he's at the Pentagon with the American Army. So Frank Turpel wasn't embarrassed by what went on. He did a little blackmailing. He has about 22 pages of names and orders and places, and he flashed them on the screen. And if those names were really made public and not called national security, we would be rid of people like Richard Allen and William Casey and Alexander Haig and George Bush. If all of that came out, that's the big if, we get rid of them. But the American system doesn't want to reveal its dirty linen, so it's not very likely that what he had printed on the page, and we only got a glimpse of it in a few seconds, that this will ever be made public. Even in the House Intelligence Committee, it'll be hushed up. He talked about carrying poison through the London airport and on commercial airlines and canisters of deadly poisons. And when he was asked about it, he gave an answer which was very logical. He said it's no different than Dow Chemical. They make poisons and paraquat, and they don't feel guilty about this. Frank Turple's in business. A buck's a buck. And Americans have this way, this capitalistic system of printing anything you want, even his documents on the people he dealt with. And the government will protect them and make us the victims of some more mayhem. He gets away with doing these things and is protected by the court system, by the news media, and he makes millions and millions of dollars. As I say, that's the capitalist system. Frank Turple is rich. He's a multimillionaire. He's had a lot of money. There's a picture of his home in Virginia, the sunken tub and so forth, $3 million home there and about that. And he's a very wealthy man in London. He has property all over the world around with Edwin Wilson and all those other people. A co-worker of theirs was arrested in Fort Worth. She came home for Christmas holidays to be with her son. She spends, this is a woman agent, a woman held in Fort Worth and in Dallas, and then she was sent to Washington. Her name is Roberta Jean Barnes, and she was held with $200,000 bond. She put up $20,000 of it. She just wanted to see her son for Christmas. She runs the London office for Edwin Wilson, who ships the bombs and explosives out of London to other countries. A nice lady, I suppose. A lot of women travel around. You wouldn't know them. The Houston Post said she's not a cloak and dagger operator. She travels in the open. She's not a Mata Hari. She manages the London office of Edwin Wilson and helps Wilson and Turple Coca-Cola just send weapons all over, explosives to Gaddafi or the people they choose all over the world. She's having to go home for Christmas and was picked up and let out. And she's an ally, a buddy of this team traveling around. You just don't know when you travel and go through these airports and these people, part of this team, are traveling. You wouldn't recognize them or know them, men, women, or whatever. They use both sexes, and they look inconspicuous. They use their own name, and she was arrested as part of the team and will be questioned by the House Intelligence Committee. If you saw that TV movie of Frank Turple, you saw a warehouse, a stockpile of guns all along the wall where they get their guns. They didn't identify it. They had Aramco, the name of the place, but they didn't say, this is Samuel Cummings. He comes from Philadelphia. He's in the CIA. His warehouse is in London. We've talked about it on these programs. But they showed you the silencers. His silencers are used for assassinations. They're obtained from Mitchell Werbel down in Warm Springs, Georgia. And he's now moved to Texas. And Samuel Cummings is the hit. Senator John Tower of Texas' wife is a sister of Samuel Cummings. Lilla Burt Cummings Tower, that is the sister of the arms dealer whose weapons were on the screen with Frank Turple's story. His sister is married to Senator John Towers from the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Ronald Reagan just gave her a new appointment, Lilla Burt Cummings Tower. The wife of Republican Senator John Tower of Texas is going to be director of the Department of Education's Institute of Museum Services. It's interesting. She's going to head a $12 million budget in 1981 of museums, and she's been given this government appointment on a full salary by Ronald Reagan at this time when her husband, Senator John Tower, is in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, which is okay, but her brother is Samuel Cummings. Her brother supplies Edwin Wilson and Frank Turple, the fellow you saw, with the weapons. Her brother does, and the brother is under investigation for a terrible criminal activity of arming our alleged enemies, allegedly using CIA stockpiles. We know there's CIA. Of heading assassination teams, of being responsible for murders, hit teams around the world. And while the brothers are being investigated While these men are being investigated, they use her brother's arms stockpile. Ronald Reagan gave her a $50,000 a year appointment. The wife of Senator John Tower is the sister of Samuel Cummings, whose warehouse you saw on the screen with Frank Turple. She's now earning $50,000 by the government. Even though these investigations go on, she and, like her brother Samuel Cummings, are born in Philadelphia. His offices are down in Monte Carlo, and of course he's up to his ears in supplying all kinds of fascist organizations and Nazi organizations. If he funds Turple, and Turple is involved in shooting the Pope, then the guns of Samuel Cummings are used to attempt the shooting of Ronald Reagan and the Pope, because the new articles coming out link these people together, these alleged assassins that tried it in March and May, and Frank Turple is directly linked to those people. We'll take a 1 minute break and get back some more to the Turple story and other news.
This concludes.